Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Columbus was chosen as one of the world sites for the Light the World giving machines. Find out what that means and how you can get involved. Plus, Jay Fox will speak with a doctor from the CDC about a special program involving flu shots. He'll also talk with someone from the USDA about emergency food funding, and we'll learn about a new program to help veterans experiencing homelessness. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Columbus is one of the select locations to participate in a local launch event for Light the World giving machines. Sarah Ellison and Maddie Knotsman join us now from Central Ohio's Ronald McDonald House Charities. Ladies, what is a giving machine?
So a giving machine is part of an initiative set up by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which was to invite everyone across the world to celebrate the life of Jesus Christ and his birth. And they invite you to do that by doing small acts of kindness and service to people all around the world. And so to help people accept that invitation, they put together a giving machine that looks a lot like a vending machine, but is a giant red one. And instead of buying candy or chips or a drink for yourself, you can buy tangible items to donate to those that are in need. And so there are various items that you can donate, from clean water to healthy food to transportation, or helping those that, you know, have sick children in the hospital, where you can get warm showers, meals, all sorts of things. So it's a way to connect those that want to help during this Christmas season to those that may be in need.
So walk me through this. I see this machine at Polaris Fashion Place, and I walk up to it, and how do I interact with it?
You interact with it like you would any sort of vending machine. You would go up to it, and inside of it, there would be cards that explain what type of items you can donate. So if you see something from, you know, like the Ronald McDonald House Charities of Central Ohio, you could see a card that says that you could purchase 50 loads of laundry for a family that is caring for their child in the hospital. And so say like that's on, you know, E16, you type that in, you swipe, you know, a credit card, a debit card, or Apple Pay, or whatever what you want to do. And you get that card, you get a receipt, and then the giving machines at the end of the season will send it to the various charities, or in this case, the Ronald McDonald House, send them the receipts of what people purchased, and then the Ronald McDonald House would carry out that act of service.
So it's kind of like online giving, but in an atmosphere where there are a lot of people who likely would be doing their holiday shopping at that time anyway, correct?
Correct. And it, you know, you also get just the atmosphere and the energy of getting the feel of, you know what, I see other people giving, I see the joy that it brings, I see what it does, the unification it brings to everyone, and I want to join in and be a part of that too.
So how did Columbus get so lucky to be selected as a participating city?
That's a good question. We're happy about it. I know that they take their time in deciding it. This year they've picked 108 cities, which is almost double from the year before, And, you know, I think it is a place where there are so many good charities that are set up that we could partner with. And we're excited to help serve our local community.
So what role is the Central Ohio Ronald McDonald House Charities playing in this endeavor? Obviously, you could be a recipient, but are you a facilitator as well?
I'll let you add. Yeah, go ahead, Maddie.
We are one of the benefiting charities of this incredible initiative. So we are one of five charities in this local Columbus community that's having the opportunity to participate in this very unique way of giving.
Now, you guys had a launch event on November 15th at Polaris Fashion Place, and it was packed, and you had a very special MC who we all know and love in Columbus. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Jim Tressel was one of the keynote speakers and MC, and obviously he has a similar faith in Christ and saw the opportunity and the force of good that these giving machines could have, the impact that it has not only on the recipient but on the giver. I know he shares a faith in Christ where, it's kind of interesting. Christ once said, "For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it." There's almost a paradox there where, you know, you would think that in order to make your own life better, you would only focus on yourself. But what Christ teaches is that when you give to others, there is a joy there. There is an uplifting factor there. And then on the recipient's end, you know, they are able to feel God's love by knowing that somebody out there cares for you. And then it gives them an opportunity, depending on the type of gift that they have, but it can restore dignity. It can be a launching pad to regaining self-reliance and control over their lives. And so I think that regardless of who you are or what your faith is or what your creed is, what your background is, we can all be united behind this idea of giving. And Jim Tressel was a big part of that.
Well, you kind of already answered my next question, which is everyone who has spent even 10 minutes inside Polaris Fashion Place knows that it is a forum for multicultural interaction. And by being inclusive for all faiths and creeds to participate in this project, you have made this a very inclusive endeavor, correct?
Yeah, and it's really a good time to do that. You know, we just got, you know, finished with an election season, which sometimes can be very divisive and, you know, lots of arguing and disagreement, which can be good, obviously, those, you know, the disagreement and that and those type of conversations. But at the same time, you want to come back together and you want to unite and you want to see that despite our differences of opinion and things like that, we can come back together, love one another, and serve the way Christ would.
How long are the machines going to be at the mall?
Yeah, so the launch was November 15th, and they will be there until Saturday, December 7th.
And are there any plans for this to be a recurring annual event?
I don't know that yet. I sure hope so. I know a lot of other cities that have had it, that it's come back. Sometimes they try to, take the machines. They keep trying to build new ones, and that's why this year they were able to have 108 cities. But also, you know, they will take a look at the landscape across the globe and see where they can serve. So sometimes machines are sent to other cities, but sometimes they stay put. But we sure hope here in Columbus they can stay put.
So we want to encourage you to go out to Polaris Fashion Place on the north end of Columbus and check out the Light the World giving machines. Our thanks to Sarah Ellison and Maddie Knotsman from Central Ohio's Ronald McDonald House Charities for being on the program and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
Ohio is an agriculture state, and Central Ohio is a huge part of that. Statewide, over 200,000 people work in the livestock, dairy, and poultry industries, and the Center for Disease Control has launched a seasonal flu vaccine program specifically for that population that will impact the people here in Ohio. Dr. Lizette Duran joins us now from the CDC. Welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Why was Ohio selected to participate in this program with those other states?
Great question. So Ohio is a part of states that have currently are showing signs of H5 bird flu in dairy cattle. So all states with dairy herds that had tested positive for H5 bird flu are invited to apply to receive additional doses of seasonal flu vaccine. This was beyond what was already planned for the state for the general public, and these doses are specifically allocated for farm workers.
So how will the farm workers gain access to the vaccines?
So states are doing this promotion in a variety of ways. Some states are having mobile vaccine clinics. They're also partnering with local public health agencies and community-based organizations to organize mass vaccination events. In order to get the information out, states can have virtual town halls and vaccination education partnerships and workshops in order to get the information out to the public.
Does the flu vaccine that is available at grocery and drug stores now not protect these workers?
So the vaccine that's available right now is the seasonal flu vaccine. That protects against seasonal flu. However, the current status is that what we're trying to do is protect farm workers against having the rare possibility of a co-infection between seasonal flu and H5 bird flu. The seasonal flu vaccine does not protect against H5 bird flu. It's a different virus.
So what happens if you get both?
There's a rare possibility that when a person is infected with both seasonal flu and H5, that they could combine to create a virus that will make H5 more readily adaptable to humans and spread more readily between humans.
That sounds horrible. How do we get these farm workers who typically rural people are the last people to get vaccines? So what do you do to encourage the town halls or the acceptance of the mobile units?
Right. So we are currently partnering with community-based organizations that do outreach specifically to farm workers. And these are organizations that have been working in these communities a lot longer than we have and that have a reputation working with the farm workers. So we're trying to build upon the reputation that they have developed over the years and working with them in conjunction to help spread the information about vaccines, about everyday preventative measures that they can also take in addition to vaccines, such as washing their hands with soap and water regularly. And when they are working, wearing personal protective equipment or PPE when they are around potentially infected animals or around raw cow's milk or around surfaces that might be contaminated with the virus. So again, we're partnering with our community-based organizations to get this word out to the farm workers, form up an organization and partners that they do trust.
So we want to be on the lookout for the seasonal flu vaccines, especially if you happen to be someone who works in the livestock, dairy, and poultry industry in the state of Ohio or in our listening area. I want to thank Dr. Lizette Duran from the CDC for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
The holiday season is upon us, and food remains one of the top concerns for Americans. The USDA has a program to help emergency food providers, and its benefits are far-reaching. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective is Jenny Lester Moffitt, the USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs. Welcome, and happy holidays.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, Jay. Happy holidays to you as well.
Secretary, tell us about the support the USDA is providing for emergency food providers and underserved communities.
Yeah, as we approach Thanksgiving and the holiday season as a whole, food is certainly top of mind for so many people. We're really excited at USDA that we're able to announce additional funding that we've been able to make for food banks and food pantries. This additional $500 million that we're announcing through a program called the Local Food Purchase Assistance allows food banks to be able to purchase local foods, including fruits, vegetables, and nuts from local and regional farmers.
Why is it so important that we source locally?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different things. Of course, the purchasing power that food banks have when they're purchasing local, that does a number of different things. It's supporting local farmers and producers in the region who are employing folks in the region as well, right? So it's really great for the local economy to be able to buy local. You're also supporting local jobs and industries in the region. Also, another important aspect is the producers who are producing in the region are also growing food that is very culturally and regionally relevant for that region. So food banks and pantries are able to buy local staples that are really important for consumers. And then I think the last thing is, of course, just the deliciousness of when we buy food that is fresh, when we buy food that is from our own community, and just the pride that the farmers have to be able to supply to food banks and pantries, but also just how delicious that food can be when we're eating locally.
As you know, we suffered exceptional drought in central Ohio over the summer and fall months this year. Will this be a boom for producers and farmers in central Ohio?
I think this this is part of, I would say, a whole system of things that farmers and ranchers need. And so certainly, of course, the work that we do at USDA on conservation practices helps farmers and ranchers with things like drought and managing all of the different aspects on the farming operation. But absolutely, being able to have high-value market opportunities within their community and within, of course, the across the nation as well, is really important to producers who are suffering from crop losses and the financial hit, to be able to have their markets bring that revenue that they really need is really important as well.
Homelessness and the hungry has been an issue in this country for a very long time. What long-term effects do you hope to see from this avenue of funding?
Yeah, long-term is really critical. We know, our goal, of course, is that no one needs to go to a food bank. Unfortunately, that is just not the case right now. And so what we see as long-term effects is really bolstering the power and opportunities that food banks and pantries have to be stronger within their community, be a strong economic driver within their community, be a critical place and resource for folks. But we also know that we really need to reinvest in local agriculture economies, because those farmers are and food producers are employing people locally, and that's really critical long-term to the economic success. So we've been, in the Biden-Harris administration, focused on long-term sustainability, long-term market opportunities, and increased market value for farmers and ranchers across the country. And Ohio is certainly no exception. This funding that we're announcing today is couples and combines with funding that we've already announced for the same program over the past few years. For Ohio, that's meant $26 million. So $26 million being channeled back into local agricultural markets for farmers to be able to sell their product to the food banks throughout Ohio.
We have the SNAP program here in Ohio, which enables people in need to go buy food wherever the SNAP program is accepted. But that may not necessarily apply to everyone. So where can listeners go to find a local emergency food provider if they need one and don't have access to SNAP resources?
Yeah, for anyone interested in finding a local food pantry, they can dial 211 to access a local service that can connect them with agencies and community organizations that offer food assistance in the area. There's also a USDA National Hunger Hotline, which is 1-866-3-HUNGRY or 1-866-348-6479. To get immediate food assistance information as well.
We want to thank Jenny Lester Moffitt, USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, for being with us to talk about this important issue and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
The Department of Veterans Affairs recently announced that it has permanently housed more than 41,000 homeless veterans across the country, meeting the agency's original goal a month early. Joining us to discuss the VA's housing first approach is Meg Cabot, who's chief of staff in the Department of Veteran Affairs. Welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Jay.
Where does the Veterans Administration attribute the success, and how did we get this a month early?
Well, the past several years, we've been very focused on identifying appropriate affordable housing for our veterans. And this past year, what we've done is really doubled down on partnerships. You know, VA cannot do this work alone. We work closely with the federal government, the state government, county, city, town, and even neighborhoods to really address this problem of veteran homelessness. So this year, we've developed a concept that we call One Team, where we really focus in on those collaborations and working individuals together, meeting several times a week to talk about all of the veterans in their community who are experiencing homelessness, identify the resources that they need, and get them into initially temporary housing and then permanent housing. So that teamwork has really been the key to our success this past year.
Have you done any demographic analysis as to the age of these veterans, or does it vary?
It really varies across the country. We do know that there is an aging population, and they have very unique needs, an aging veteran population who can experience homelessness, and we have to provide them with very specific kinds of care. But we also know that we have younger veterans who may have families who are either experiencing homelessness or on the verge of homelessness, and we have all kinds of different programming to address those very specific needs.
So what does the military do when somebody is discharged in terms of making sure that their after service life is suitable?
It's a great question. And again, it's something that we all need to work on together. You know, the DOD actually provides a series of trainings to individuals as they transition to become veterans. VA participates in that, as does the Department of Labor. It's something we call our Transition Assistance Program. And, you know, VA works very hard, especially with specific veterans, veterans who may have experienced mental health issues or who are on the or are concerned about their homelessness. We encourage every individual who's about to leave the military or has already left the military to contact their local VA to meet with a case manager, to be assessed, and to get enrolled in VA healthcare, because that really can be the starting point to a whole additional series of benefits and resources for them as they transition.
When we work with the homeless in terms of law enforcement and social work, do we ask the homeless whether they have served or are they forthcoming on their own?
Well, great question. And again, this is a part where this is a something that we can all do as citizens in whatever role we're in, is to ask individuals if they have served. Sometimes veterans aren't aware that they are eligible for certain services, and sometimes individuals don't even identify themselves as veterans. So it's an important question to ask, have you served? And if the answer is yes, then to recommend that that individual or to help that individual connect to VA, and they can do that at va.gov. That's a great place to start to really get information about what they may be eligible for.
Now, the state of Ohio has a lot of veterans, and specifically Columbus, Ohio, has a homeless population. Have you been able to drill down to find out how many folks in Columbus and Central Ohio you were able to help as a result of those 41,000?
Well, we absolutely track our homeless populations at all of our medical centers across the country, and I know that we did experience a significant amount of success in Columbus and some of the other major cities in Ohio.
So when you talk about the services that are provided to these homeless veterans, obviously aside from finding permanent and or temporary housing, what other services are provided for them?
So I think that one of the biggest things that we do in our homeless program is outreach. And that means going out to where those veterans are living, whether they're in shelters or not in shelters. And we have a large dedicated staff. Many of that staff are veterans. Many of them are formerly homeless veterans. So they really understand what it's like to be in that kind of experience. And so they're going to shelters. They're going under bridges. They're going wherever veterans may be living to offer services, to provide assistance, and to make sure that that veteran has everything that they can need, and eventually to get them into temporary housing and then permanent housing.
Is this Housing First initiative sustainable?
It absolutely is sustainable, and it must be sustainable. The idea here behind Housing First, and we know there's real evidence behind it that this works, is that we have to get our veterans into stable housing without a lot of barriers, without a lot of rules, without a lot of paperwork for that veteran, so that they can get into a stable housing situation and then take advantage of all of the resources that VA and the community have to offer.
What is the cost per veteran that's associated with the program?
Well, you know, I think our goal here is to end veteran homelessness, and we're going to do that no matter what it takes and how much it takes. I thank Congress for their ongoing, really bipartisan support of our homeless programs. and really look forward to the day when I can come on the radio with you, Jay, and talk about that we've ended veteran homelessness in this country.
Well, I'm hoping you can do more than that, Meg, because we've got a homelessness problem that transcends the military community, and maybe Housing First could be an approach that non-veteran communities could take?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we know that the groups that we work with in the community are also often working with non-veteran homeless. And we know that they're taking some of our lessons learned and some of our approaches and applying them to homeless individuals, regardless of whether or not they served.
So if folks want to dig in and learn the details of Housing First, is there a website that they can go to for more information?
Absolutely. It's va.gov/homeless.
I want to thank Meg Cabot, the Chief of Staff for the Department of Veterans Affairs, for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
A newcomer and an outsider, Senator-elect Bernie Moreno will officially hold his first elected office when he's sworn into the U.S. Senate in January. After what he called a grueling two-year campaign, Republican Senator-elect Moreno takes over a seat held for the last 18 years by a Democrat. He won the race with 50.2% of the vote to Sherrod Brown's 46.4. His victory helped flip the Senate to a Republican majority. Senator-elect Moreno is here to talk about the big issues as he prepares to take office. Senator-elect, first of all, thank you for your time and for coming in for Face the State. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with that promise that you made to voters who didn't vote for you. How are you going to work practically to win them over?
So what we've already started. So what we've done is we've gone out and done reach out to the Hispanic community in Columbus and in Cleveland, to the Black community in both of those cities as well. Talked to non-traditional groups where Republicans just don't go in there enough. I think it's different when you go in there as a senator versus going there as a candidate, because I think the community looks at it and goes, well, you're only here because you want my vote. So now we've already been in office. We know we're going to be in office. So it's about making an outreach and seeing what their issues are. What are they concerned about? We've also reached out to all the mayors of Cuyahoga County. We'll do the same thing in Franklin and in Hamilton to see what issues, how can my office be helpful to them?
And also setting up offices in places where you had talked about Athens County.
Yes.
As being a potential for an office that you would set up.
Yeah, we want to make sure we're in every corner of the state and that we have an incredible constituent services operation. In fact, we're going to have more staff in Ohio than in Washington, D.C., which sets a priority. We want to really create a constituent services operation that rivals the best of the private sector.
Let's talk about the big news that's happening right now as President-elect Trump begins to fill his cabinet and put forth his nominees. You came out strongly in support of his nominees this past week, including Matt Gaetz, whom stepped out of the race yesterday or earlier this week and said that he was withdrawing his name from the nomination. Now Pam Bondi is in place as that nominee. First of all, Matt Gaetz, what do you think about him pulling his name out of consideration?
I think it was a heroic thing that he did. He didn't have to. I think he could have stayed in the fight, but he would have distracted, of course, like he said, what we need to do, which is we need to stay focused and united as a Republican Party. Look, the reality is every single Democrat voted to confirm President Trump's cabinet. There wasn't one Democrat that made one negative comment about any of Joe Biden's picks. And objectively, Joe Biden has had the worst cabinet in American history. So what we have to do as Republicans is understand that President Trump received a mandate, and we owe him the opportunity to govern with a team that he's going to select. So I have full faith and confidence in President Trump to select the team that he's most comfortable with, and it's incumbent upon us to get that team confirmed as soon as humanly possible.
Nominee for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, also faces some accusations from a woman who says he sexually assaulted her. It was investigated. He didn't face any charges out of it. Does that kind of accusation give you any pause in supporting him when he does come up for confirmation?
No, not at all. We don't live in a justice system that accuses people because of allegations, especially allegations that were investigated and not found to be credible. So at the end of the day, we have to go by a justice system in which if there's a result that where there is a conviction, but there's a presumption of innocence, right? So we can't be defaming people because of accusations. Look, in my own primary, there's lots of accusations launched at me that were absolutely, totally, and completely false. So we can't judge nominees that way. Pete's a great man. Went to Princeton, went to Harvard. He's a combat veteran, a hero, great communicator. He's going to do some great things in the Department of Defense.
And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has been a big supporter of the president-elect. He's been criticized for some of his stances on vaccines and also on unpasteurized milk. Do you have any concerns about him, or why do you support him for the office?
Yeah, you got to remember, we need reformers in these agencies. And at the end of the day, the agenda that those cabinet nominees are intended to do is President Trump's agenda. So it's what does President Trump want them to do in HHS? So Robert Kennedy's not going there as President of the United States to run HHS. He's going there as somebody who's going to fulfill the agenda of President Trump, which is to make the government more efficient, deliver better health care to this country at a lower cost.
Let me go back to Pam Bondi, first of all, for now the new pick for attorney general. What do you think of her, the former Florida attorney general?
Yeah, I know her very well. We did a panel together actually in Toledo during the primary. She's great. She's ruthless on these criminals. Look, if I'm a Mexican drug cartel member and Pam Bondi's going to be the attorney general, you better watch out. If you're somebody who is conducting illegal narcotic activities in Ohio or anywhere in America, Pam Bondi's coming after you. She's a absolute phenomenal pick. I expect a full unanimous vote on her on the Republican side. And I think she's going to pick up a few Democrat votes, honestly.
Now, you have you've made border security and immigration a big issue. I know it's one of your priorities. President-elect Trump has said he wants to do a mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. How can the administration pull off something of that scale when you're talking 11 million to 13 million potential immigrants?
Well, you got to remember, we've had about 10 to 13 million people come in over the last 3.5 years. So it's obvious that we can also expel them over the same period of time. And it's a national security imperative. These people have not been vetted. We have no idea who they really are. If you go to the Border Patrol agents themselves will tell you they have had no time, no opportunity to vet them. We know that at least 500,000 or more are convicted criminals. We've flown in criminals and rapists and murderers into this country. So we start with the worst of the worst. My personal belief, and I have not discussed this with the president, but my personal belief is that we should not house foreign nationals in our jails at all. So we need to expel any foreign national that's in any of our prisons. We're not going to spend that. Or if that country refuses to take a convicted prisoner from their country, that we should charge them a huge sum of money per prisoner per year and take that money through means that we have through our banking system. So we're just not going to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars housing people that shouldn't have been here.
The American Immigration Council estimates the cost of this mass deportation for arrests, detention, processing, removal, as well as the costs for, to the economy and the tax base and jobs, would be about $300 billion. How can the administration justify spending that much money on this plan?
Well, the estimates are that taking care of illegals in this country was costing us $451 billion per year. This is free health care, free education, housing, the impact on our communities, the increase in housing costs. So I think that number could be accurate, but it's a huge savings, and it's a one-time expense. The $451 billion is every single year, and it repeats on over. The $300 billion, if that number is even accurate, I have no idea. I've not looked at that, but that seems like an enormous, a great return on investment. And most importantly, look, we have to send a signal to the world. There's one path to America, the legal path. And I'm obviously a supporter of legal immigration on our terms, but you can't have a robust legal immigration system unless you set up a community where you have a zero tolerance policy for illegal entrants or illegals to stay here at all.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Senator-elect Bernie Moreno will be Ohio's senior senator, even though he is brand new to the Senate. That's because Governor DeWine will choose the replacement for Vice President-elect J.D. Vance when Vance resigns from his Senate seat. Senator-elect Moreno is my guest for the entire program today. Senator-elect, first of all, have you talked to the governor yet about whom you would like to see fill that seat?
Well, I've given him, I think ideas of, to generally speaking, the kind of person he should select, and we're totally aligned on that. It's got to be somebody who can raise money, somebody who's not going to draw a big primary opponent, somebody who can easily win a general election 26 and 28, somebody who's willing to work hard and make certain that they make an effort, and somebody who understands how the Senate works. And actually, what's interesting is Governor DeWine has been a senator, and so he understands the Senate uniquely, different than most other governors who are making this decision. So I'm confident he'll make the right decision.
You criticized Senator Brown for voting almost 100% of the time with the Biden administration. I'm curious if there are areas where you will depart from President Trump in once you're in office.
Well, my criticism of Sherrod Brown was that he voted almost 100% of the time with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and yet ran a campaign in which he said he fought with Biden and Harris and didn't go along with them. So it was just a total lie that he was somebody who was bipartisan or moderate. He should have run a campaign in which he defended his votes and defended his position. President Trump endorsed me in the primary. I endorsed him before he endorsed me because we're aligned ideologically. We both know that we have to create an agenda for American greatness, an agenda that reindustrializes this country, sets up a situation where we leave this country better for our kids and grandkids, shrinks the size of the federal government, has peace and stability around the world, and that we have a safe and secure border. So we're totally aligned, and those are going to be the priorities that we get done over the next 4 years while he's in the White House.
And at this point, you don't see any areas where you might split?
No, right now, look, we have an agenda. That's what's great about business people is we put together these are the things that we want to do. It's called Agenda 47. Your viewers can look that up. Mm-hmm. It's 20 bullet points, and we're going to focus everything on that.
What's the biggest challenge that you see for Ohioans right now that you're going to tackle right away?
We have to lower the price of everything. Look, living a normal life has gotten something that's out of reach for most Ohioans, whether it's affording a home, affording rent, affording a car, something I care a lot about. You know, the average price car is almost $50,000. The average car payment is well over $500 a month. That's not affordable for most people. And then used car prices continue to be high. There's only four cars that really are available that are under $25,000 brand new. That's untenable for most people. So even though paychecks may be going up a little bit more, you're making a little bit more, you're falling further and further behind. We need to make sure we have safety in our communities. We're seeing that in Columbus. People here need to feel like we live in a safe community. We have to have good schools. We have to shrink the size of the federal government. So those are the priorities that we're going to really tackle.
You've also talked a lot about the importance of being energy dominant. How would that help people here?
Well, Ohio sits on 1,000 years of natural gas. I mean, we are sitting on a gold mine in eastern Ohio. We should be an energy dominant nation, but Ohio will disproportionately benefit from that. So between natural gas, coal, we should have a moratorium on shutting down any more coal-fired plants because we need that energy. We got to be investing in nuclear, which is the ultimate form of green energy. We have oil refineries here in Ohio that we make certain that we protect. We need strong energy dominance because it's with reliable, affordable energy that allows us to bring manufacturing back at scale to the United States. So those are the things that, and by the way, it's the input cost for almost everything. We got to lower the cost of prices.
You also talked in your victory speech about cutting government spending. How bad is it, in your opinion, and what can you do about it? How will you attack that situation?
Oh, it's outrageous. I mean, the amount of money we spend on nonsense, and it's not trillion-dollar items. There's not going to be one thing that you say, hey, get rid of this, you save $1 trillion. There is a lot of low-hanging fruit. Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk, if any two duo can make this happen, it's them. So the Department of Government Efficiency, they're going to get right to work. And I think we can cut $2 trillion out of our federal budget.
Do you support cutting the Department of Education?
Absolutely. I ran on that. President Trump is 100% behind that. And just to be clear, eliminating the Department of Education at the federal level, which is 4,400 bureaucrats, which suck up a lot of resources, doesn't mean defunding public education. It's the exact opposite. We'll move that money to the states where they can implement it much more efficiently.
So the programs that are paid for right now by the federal government, such as the targeted assistance for at-risk kids for reading and math, support of neglected and delinquent kids, that funding will stay there? Those programs will stay in place?
Well, I don't know about the programs because that's going to be up to the states. What I'm saying is the entire bucket pool of money will go to the states. Think about this. A dollar goes to the federal government. The Department of Education probably returns 20 cents to the states. So you're wasting enormous amounts of money in bureaucracy. Let's take the money that goes into the federal government, move it back to the states at a dollar for dollar value, and let the states decide what their priorities are. The state here in Ohio may decide something different in California or Massachusetts, and that's perfectly fine. I'm more confident in our state legislators and our governor to implement what they need to do education-wise.
I do want to touch on it just the minute or so we have left in this particular segment. Abortion was a big issue in the election, in particular in campaign ads against you. I want to give you the chance to clarify your position on that and whether you support a federal nationwide ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy.
Look, there's no votes in either direction, whether it's codifying Roe versus Wade or putting any kind of restrictions at the federal level. The votes just don't exist. So I think what voters are going to find out in a couple years when there's the midterms is that the Democrats lied to them. The Democrats said that if I got elected and President Trump won, that abortion would be immediately banned. It overturned the will of the voters. What they're going to find is that there's just no votes at the federal level. It's not what we're going to work on. We're going to work on securing our border, having energy dominance, lowering inflation, peace around the world. So this was the return to the states. But what we can do is lower the cost of adoptions, lower the cost of having children, fund pregnancy centers, have equal access for women to contraception and health care. Those are the things that we'll work on. We're going to bring the country together on this issue.
Thank you, Senator-elect, so much for your time.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.